Welcome to The Business Show. We believe that our journey through this world is one we must take together, expanding, learning, and growing as a united force. We know that history is being made right now, and the decisions we make today will shape our tomorrow. These decisions will not only impact us, but will define the future for generations to come. If we don't make the right choices now, we risk creating a future we don't want. That's why we're here, to slay the dragons of the modern world and to face the challenges it brings head on. The future demands that we come together to tackle these challenges, and the only way forward is through unity and collaboration. Let's rise together, undivided but united. A warm welcome to yet another episode on the Carmen Murray Show. Today we are going to unpack the challenges that exist within the cybersecurity landscape and try to understand what are the challenges that are within cyber resilience and what do we need to do to armor ourselves so that we can build a more sustainable future. With me in studio today is a phenomenal teacher, but also a phenomenal woman that specializes in cybersecurity. Her name is Busi Amate. Amate, hope you are doing well. A warm welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Carmen. I am exceptionally well.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. Listen, I don't know where you get time to get the day job done, but I see that you are serving on so many boards. So you are an independent non-executive director for MTN, for Cura Holdings, also for Discovery Health Medical Scheme and now Famous Brands, plus you run your own consultancy. I mean, like, what goes on in your life on a day-to-day basis?
I remember my dad saying to me when I was young, you only have 24 hours in a day and you choose how to use them. So it seems like a lot, but if you love something and you really want to make a difference, it becomes part of who you are. Don't get me wrong, I get tired, but my daily routine, I have to hit that gym every morning so that I'm energized and I'm able to go for long periods. Mm. And I love what I'm doing.
So what is it exactly that you do?
So what do? I help organizations, and this is from SMMEs, startups, all the way to listed entities, really understand cybersecurity landscape and think about what controls they need to put in place to become resilient. Because gone are those days when you speak about cybersecurity, because cybersecurity is just about protecting and preventing unauthorized access to your system. Mm. But cyber resilience says we are going to get that unauthorized access to our systems. We are going to get hackers coming in. But how do we make sure that we actually are able to adapt and recover quickly? Mm. So it is, once we've been attacked, what processes, people, technology do we have to ensure that we are able to run our business? So it goes back to your sustainability. How do we ensure we are sustainable? We get hacked now, in a few hours or immediately, we are able to still continue running our business.
Yeah. And, you know, something that really fascinates me about this world is, when you start looking at the annual reports of organizations and all the risk mitigation that needs to happen, it makes you realize the immense burden that comes with, you know, cyber resilience. Mm. As you always say, it's not a matter of if I'm going to get hacked or there's going to be a breach, it's how many times it's going to happen. And, you know, this just shows you, I mean, I think you once mentioned that the CISOs are on call. Mm. Like, if anything happens, they can't just like have a normal holiday. If something happens while they're on holiday, they need to act. It's a very big thing. It's like, it's a serious job.
It is. I mean, if you ask me, one of the most stressed people within organizations now are probably your chief technology officers, because you have to make so many decisions around technology. Mm. Technology rationalization, what do you bring on board? How do you bring it on board? Is it fit for purpose? And is it actually going to help us from a resilience perspective? Then the CISOs, chief information security officers, I'm never going to put up my hand for that position because I believe they carry so much stress. If anything happens, and as simple as somebody cannot log in, and they might have just forgotten their password, might have been a group of people, something has just happened. The CISO needs to have an answer immediately. So it is, you always have to be on top of things. They need to understand what's happening from a business perspective. They need to understand what's going to happen in the next 5 years. So what is the strategy of the organization, and how are we placed to support that strategy? Because it's not about solving a problem for now. Resilience is about solving a problem for the future. So I think CISOs are under immense stress, and that's why for me it's really important for them to start sitting at the right tables where decisions are being made. And when those decisions are being made, they're able to influence what that would mean from a security perspective.
I really love that. I think I want to circle back, almost going back into this world of cyber threats. It's quite big. I mean, geopolitics is becoming a huge conversation. Tech nationalism, there's the data sovereignty, digital sovereignty, all of these discussions amongst the evolution of technology. As much as you becoming resilient, the counterparts are finding ways to hack.
That's true.
So perhaps you can create a understanding of what does the threat landscape look like at the moment, and what are you seeing?
So, Carmen, I think you're spot on what you've mentioned, geopolitical threats. And if you think about the number of elections that are taking place in 2024, some of the elections taking place in 2025, that really creates a different perspective around geopolitics. If you think about the East and the West and the wars that are happening and how some of the tech is dependent or is done in those countries, the impact on technology, which is your second thing that you mentioned. So, the third one around data sovereignty. Data has become a currency that organizations are actually saying, we're going to convert this into some sort of an intangible asset so that I want to know my customer. I need to understand my customer. I need to be able to give Carmen what she needs. Mm-hmm. So your data has become important to organizations. And hackers have realized that. But when you talk about emerging technologies, I think one thing that really interests me, it's one important one that really sticks out, around AI. Because threat actors are now using AI to be more sophisticated. So they're now using AI. You can get somebody who actually doesn't even understand technology, who has never hacked before. They can go onto an AI platform and really start playing around, and they could actually start hacking organizations without even realizing it. So the threat landscape is really increasing, and it's changing at a rapid pace. But what I often get asked by organizations is, there are so many threats that are happening. Where do I start? And for me, that's what's important. I always say you always have to have a view of your threat landscape. But you can't protect everything. I mean, if there's an organization that believes they can protect everything, then they are really printing money because it's expensive.
Yeah.
So if you go back to geopolitics, I think it's important. So for example, I'd say to organizations, before you even start, think about my locations. Think about the data you're processing and where is it? Where is it coming from? Where is it residing? Which countries does it cross before it gets to where it needs to go? Think about the third thing I'd say you need to think about is technology stack. So what technology am I using? Who's supporting this technology? Is it from another country? And being in Africa, most of the technology we use is not South African is not African technology. If you think about Microsoft, if you think about all the technology stacks we have, majority of them are not done here. So as often organizations want to know, where do I start? I mean, emerging risks, any publication you open, World Economic Forum, anybody will talk about the emerging risks that are happening, geopolitical, data sovereignty, cybersecurity. They'll talk about third-party risks, you know, with dependency on third parties from an organization perspective. They also talk about AI, how AI is really becoming so important and really traversing across all different spheres of the organization. And the one question I often get asked is, but where do we start? Do we really have to, as an organization, keep abreast of all these, and which one do you prioritize? Which one do you start with? And I often say, you know, it's important to really firstly understand your locations. So if I'm an organization that's based in South Africa, where else do I operate? Because that gives you your landscape where you can start thinking, what are the impact of geopolitical? What are the impact of data sovereignty? What are the impact of third parties that I use? Similar understanding your technology stack. It's becoming very important, especially around the conversation of tech rationalization. What does it mean for me? Am I operating in a country where there's some legislation around technology, similarly to data? Do you understand where your data is sitting? What sort of data do you have? Because most hackers would, before they come, they want to know what, that some people hack for fun. I think I've had this conversation.
Yeah.
But there are other reasons why a hacker would want to come to you. So you kind of need to understand, is it, are they coming for my data because I have important or confidential data that they would want to get to?
It's fascinating. You know, in my mind, I'm trying to think, how would this work for a bank, for example? Mm. You know, banking is universal. Wherever you find yourself, you go and travel across the world, you swipe your card. How does that ecosystem of data and how it's transferred, you know, and globalization work in terms of this whole concept of tech nationalism? It's fascinating to me because I see that it's a huge conversation where infrastructure is almost brought in-house and building your own infrastructure. If that is starting to happen at government levels to protect themselves from a geopolitical perspective, surely we're going to start seeing that a lot with corporates as well, building their own infrastructure, but that must cost a fortune.
So I'm hearing two questions.
Yeah, are you hearing thoughts coming out of my mind going, oh my word, like I'm just trying to make sense of this. This is insane.
So if I, maybe let's start with the second question around, you know, infrastructure, most governments thinking about how do we build our own infrastructure. How do we use, how do we make sure from a tech perspective we don't depend on anybody else? Because then they could decide, or something could happen, we could have a huge impact on us as a government. We're seeing a lot of that happening. But what's interesting, it's just not happening in one part of the world. Typically, you'd see something start in a more advanced tech countries like, you know, your Germany, that part of the world. But what we're seeing, so many governments, even in Africa, are starting to think about, what does this mean for us? If we are so dependent on so many third parties, from a nation state perspective, geopolitical, how do we limit that? So they're starting to build their own infrastructure, starting to build their own data centers, starting to really bring stuff closer home. And this really puts a spin in the works for organizations, because I think if you think about legislation and how legislation starts and how legislation is influenced, I think in the long term, we're going to start seeing legislation that is very specific around technology, about where do you get your, how do you source your technology? How do you know where your data is being stored? How do you ensure that it's resilient? And if you cannot answer those questions very strictly, I see some sort of legislation actually kind of trying to get organizations to build this locally in country. And that's just from a geopolitical perspective, and so that we kind of understand. And also from a resilience perspective, because if the government is trying to be resilient, if organizations that are, have key infrastructure that are not part of the state, if those something happens to them, it's still a geopolitical impact and has a national impact on the government. So I see in the long term, I don't think it's going to happen in the next 5 years, Carmen, especially from an African context, because we still have a lot of things we're thinking about from an Africa perspective. So one of the big things now is about data sovereignty. What does it mean? Can us as Africa have a legislation similar to GDPR, which is for Europe? So the whole of Europe have one data privacy legislation where data can move freely around that continent, because there's an understanding and appreciation of, you know, the economic benefit that brings. So the big conversation now, which I think might be happen quicker than the tech, is around data. How do we create a national an Africa-wide data privacy legislation. So where we're able, even just from an economic perspective, to say, if data moves from this country to this country, it's going to be secured. You need to abide to these principles. And once you abide to these principles, then you can transfer data across the continent. Mm. So I think the data one is way ahead. I think the tech one, given where we are from a continental perspective, is still getting in there. And your second question around banks or these multinational organizations where they have your data and you say you easily travel, you have your card, you can swipe anywhere. I think it's because of the data. Most banks, when the data privacy legislation started in South Africa years ago, they really went in and started understanding what data privacy means, what controls they have to have. And most of the banks I have worked with actually have an agreement with different countries around data. So they've signed with the regulators, different regulators, they've signed some sort of an agreement to say that, you know, the data that's sitting in both, whichever countries we're traveling, our customers are traveling in, it's our data and it's going to be kept safe. But if you think about it, your data is probably sitting at a cloud. So it doesn't even go to that. When you swipe in America buying your Starbucks coffee, that data just traverses through Starbucks, but it's sitting in a cloud somewhere. And that's also...
And it's understanding where that cloud...
It's understanding where that cloud is operating from a data sovereignty perspective.
Very interesting. While we are still talking about the threat landscape, I wanted to... you know, also just understand from you what you think about this. Maybe it's not a big deal, but I mean, in the world of deepfake, and you know, we're seeing this evolution of that, and there's annoying call centers, you know, with people calling you all the time. AI machines calling you. How are we as ordinary citizens able to tell the difference? How do we know that the call center that's actually calling us is actually not from the company? Are these practices of having call centers do we need to start rethinking what those models look like? Because, you know, there's so many, like I probably on my day, I probably get 20 calls and they're coming from cell phones. Companies are calling from cell phones. So now you don't know if it's somebody that's actually scamming you, but then also these auto-generated messages coming through. I mean, anybody can do that. Mm. It's so easy. And this WhatsApp hacking is becoming another big thing. And I suppose it's interesting to me because we all get impacted. Mm. It's not, you know, cybersecurity and actually being conscious about how do I actually be more resilient, cyber resilient in my home and how I engage with my emails. All of those things matter because that type of habits is also going to be implemented at work. So it's from boardroom to living room. Mm. You know, we have to have these conversations.
So two things. Yes, you're loading me, hey?
I'm loading you, of course. Listen, when my mind goes, my pen is not working, so I'm just shooting at you.
So the first one around how do you get to know whether, you know, you're getting something from a call center, whether it's reputable, whether it is, I often say you're not going to know. Mm. And just because you have legislation that stipulates that, we have a Protection of Personal Information Act, and it says, unless you've opted in to receive a call, that's why when you sign the forms, you always say opt in or opt out. That we have legislation that kind of says you cannot, that organization has to get your details directly from you unless you've opted to receive marketing content.
But we know that doesn't
work. So what I'm getting to is that legislation is not going to change people's behavior.
Mm.
So I often say then educate people. So you are going to get those calls. You are going to get those automated WhatsApps. You are going to get to all those things. For me, what's important is how do you educate yourself? Mm. How do you even educate your children around cyber safety, cyber bullying? What that means, how you disclose your information, what you should disclose, what you shouldn't disclose. Because once you start building that armor, and that's the biggest armor I see are the people. Because when a phishing email hits, what has to happen? Somebody has to click on it. If somebody has to click on it so that the hacker can get onto a system. It's very rare that a hacker can just get onto a system without somebody.
Sure.
Or somebody doing something. So that's why I often say education is, for me, is more important. How do we educate people around how they need to react when they get these calls, what they need to say, what they don't need to disclose, because that is far more important than trying to say there's a piece of legislation that you need to comply with and still trying to get to these organization. But the second interesting part you're talking about is the deep fakes. So when I started in cybersecurity, would say when you're doing cyber training, would say to a financial manager, if you get an email from a CEO saying, please pay this invoice immediately, it's 1 million rand, you can just call the CEO and verify with him whether it is him. But guess what deepfake has introduced? Huh. Deepfake has actually gone to a point where they have mimicked the CEO's voice so much that you can call. I mean, I'm aware of an incident where a financial manager received an instruction from a CEO saying, please pay this immediately because we are busy with an M&A. It's still confidential. I'm just bringing you in so that you can make sure this gets paid. And the person called the CEO's number. And the CEO responded, deep fake, as if it's the CEO, same voice, same tone, same, you know, there's certain things you know about people that you've worked with for so long. This person responded, hung up, and the money was transferred.
Huh.
Only to find out it was deep fake.
Yeah.
And that's what AI has introduced. So the question is then, what do you do as humans? You know, so how do you start? So we now start talking about zero trust architecture. So where you don't trust anything.
Mm.
You don't trust anybody. There needs to be certain authentication. And that's why now for your banking app, facial recognition, finger. Because instead of calling the CEO, you can just call the CEO and say, sir, you need to authenticate. The deepfake doesn't have the CA's fingers. The deepfake doesn't have the CA's face, the CEO's face. So it's getting very complicated, but it goes back to the most important armor, educating people.
Yeah, I love that you're saying that, and you know the banks do that very well. Mm. Like they really keep it, every time when you log in, there's always a notification. Do you know
it's
about
irritating.
The latest scam?
It's irritating,
but I'd
but
rather
it's
know.
Very important.
Yeah, I'd rather know. But I do sometimes wonder if other organisations couldn't put that into their armour as well, and how you engage with other various organisations to also alert you of scams or, you know, threats that they see, because you almost feel like you're in safe hands wherever you have your money or with ever who you're transacting with, that they have your best interest at heart. So, you know, I love what you're saying there, and also making sure that we as human beings are, that we are educated, because we're not working with the technology every day.
Yeah.
We are not in the back end systems. We don't know what's going on down there, and a lot of those things are not disclosed, you know, publicly. But it is important to keep everybody's fingers on the pulse. Like zero trust is also very important, you know, those kind of things. But I digress, and I want to bring it back to, you know, now that we understand what the threat landscape looks like, you know, what shifts do we need to see for organizations, you know, to put the right proactive cybersecurity measurements in place?
So I've worked with organizations where they have very good cybersecurity strategy, very good incident response strategies, and they have some level of people engagement. And when I talk about people engagement, it's just not engagement, but it's also training and awareness and doing all the different exercises. But what I often, and I've sat in war rooms, so when an organization has been hacked and you have all the people that need to be in a room, the CISOs to technology support to insurance to in a room trying to understand what has happened, how do we react to this? And what I often see, that beautiful strategy, that incident response plan, this business continuity management, it's actually on the side and conversations are happening. And what I often say now to organization is that You can have all the papers, but until you have rehearsed it and simulated it and have done it to as best as you can, you're actually not going to know what to do. So for organizations to really get into that space, it's really taking those documents that you have consultants come and draw for you that really made sense and continuously update them. But just don't update them because you've acquired a new business or because you're going into a different market, but actually simulate them. Say, if we were to get a ransomware now and our systems are locked, and you actually act as if your systems are locked, how are we going to react? What are we going to do?
It's like a fire drill.
It's like a fire drill. Thank you. Yeah. You know, I used to do that also in my past life. We used to do business continuity and we'd get an ambulance coming in and we'd have smoke.
We'd
create the whole thing. But it's now important for organization from a security perspective. And it goes back to what I said earlier. Which markets, what data, and what's your technology? So then once you know, and what are the emerging risks? So I think I'm going to be hit by a ransomware because I'm in this industry and I've seen there's a ransomware attacks that have been happening across the globe. Or I'm in the dark web and I've seen announcements that have I actually tried it? I didn't write. It's not a policy about ransomware. Have I actually gone in and did a fire drill on the ransomware? Does everybody know where to go? Are you going to have people going up the stairs, some going down the stairs, people bumping into each other? Or do you know exactly who needs to get involved, at what point, which systems are going to be impacted, which systems are going to come up at what time, and which systems we're okay for them to come back later because those are not our core systems? Do we know who we need to report to from a regulatory perspective? You know which countries? Have we segmented our network to make sure that if it's hit this part of our business or this part of our operations, it doesn't quickly traverse to the next part? So for me, what's important when you start thinking about how do you become more resilient is how do we then start taking, because most of these things organizations are doing and they're doing it very well, is how do you start taking those and actually have a fire drill around them? But remember, fire drills, what do you need? People. How do you educate your people to walk this journey with you? How do you actually show them? I've written an article about human shields. From a security perspective, I said our biggest armor are humans. So we need human shields from a cyber perspective. Because if our humans are so educated, they're not overworked, they're not tired, they'll not click on that email.
Yeah.
They're not going to click on that email that says, it's Christmas, take a lot. Because they know you shop at Take a Lot. Take a Lot is giving specials. People click on that email because, oh, yes, I've just ordered from Take a Lot. Maybe it is. Might not be from Take a Lot.
Yeah.
So for me, it's the people and the simulations, making sure that you actually simulate. But it starts with all those things I've mentioned earlier. You can't protect yourself from everything. It's understanding what are my critical systems. And then making sure you have the right controls. And I talk about tech people. I talk about people. Tech than processes. Get your people ready. Get the technologies. Understand where your data is sitting.
Yeah. You know, as I just think about this fire drill. So I used to work on the ships many, many years ago. I used to be in charge for a raft and to do the fire drills. And it was a thing that we used to do, like, I think two or three, almost every cruise. It was quite intense.
Important, yeah.
But I cannot tell you how that mindset actually was so ingrained into us. The awareness that it drove around, like if the ship has to sink, how we have to clear the cabins, how we have to put white cloths on the door handles and make sure that we've cleared all the rooms. And, you know, once we had an incident where it really happened, and it was almost like unconsciously doing the correct thing. And this is really what this is all about, is unconsciously doing the right thing. It's like that unconscious competence.
Yes.
And this is so important when it comes to, being cyber resilient. It's also, we've seen so many things at play in the public domain where hacks happened. There's no communication. Customers are not informed because there's no communications plan. I mean, talk to me about that, and specifically what you've seen in the work that you do.
So there's probably a communication plan. There's probably even drafts that have been done. But in the moment, because nobody has ever It was done maybe 2 years ago. It's done annually. It's gone to the right channels from a governance perspective to be signed off. But nobody has ever actually gone and said, okay, guys, let's really review it now and let's actually send it. Let's start acting as if we do have a crisis. Carmen, you're the comms person. When there's a crisis, your responsibility is as soon as there's different tiers when you have crisis, as soon as it hits this tier, there is a communication template. You don't even need to change anything. There's a communication template. Understand who it goes to. And I sat in a meeting where one of the directors said, it's quite interesting when there's a cyber incident, the two most forgotten stakeholders are the employees and the board of directors.
Wow.
Because everybody's running around telling the other stakeholders. They'll tell the shareholders. They'll announce if you're listed. Now you have to tell the JSE if it's a data breach and you think there's personal information. You have to tell the regulator in South Africa. So there's so many, if you're in financial services, there's other regulatory bodies. First have told your customers, sometimes even get the CEO calling the biggest customers just to calm them down. And this director said it's often the employees and the boards that are last told.
Wow.
And I turned around, I said, is there actually a communication plan? So there is a communication plan, but do you actually have those draft communications for the board and for the employee? And that organization, the very big one, they actually realized that they actually have for suppliers, tech support, they have for all the different stakeholders, including shareholders, but they actually don't have the employees. And we've just said the employees are the heartbeat of the organization.
Yeah, the human shield,
the
right?
Human shield.
Sure.
And the board are literally the biggest decision making.
And I mean, if I just think about that, I mean, like, you would think that the employees would be the first to notify because they are going to get, the call center's going to go manic, people are going to start calling, there's going to be so many questions, especially if it's a serious threat, you know? It's interesting that.
I think it's because you can't really control what employees can do. They can put it on Twitter, they can...
That makes sense.
So it's more around how do we not, an organization say they don't want to do that because then they are going to scare their employees. It's going to be heightened. The threat might even be more heightened and they're going to start calling each other. Can you get into your system? Can you? So there's different ways to look at this, but I often say it's what and how you communicate.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just informing them. This is what has happened. We believe we cannot access. We've received this threat. We are busy dealing with it. We just want to make you aware so that if you go into social media and this is out, please do not comment. You know the company policy. As simple as that.
And I want to, you know, really understand also from you, you know, since we are talking about boards, you know, I see a lot of trends happening around boards not being informed. Or boards perhaps not being as educated on technology and the technology evolutions that are happening and the difficulty around cybersecurity to say, okay, right, these are the technologies that we require, but the budgets are not approved. What do you think is happening then? How can those conversations be facilitated better? What have you seen in your line of work?
If you're aware that in the US, from an SEC, all listed entities now, they've been mandated to have a board member who is security savvy.
Oh, wow.
And they've become very strict around reporting cyber. When you're listed to any SEC, they're very strict around within X number of hours, you need to have reported your cyber incident to, and the board needs to actually have seen it. So it needs to have gone through the board before it's reported to the regulator. We've seen in Zambia, from a financial services perspective, where there's a regulation around what the board needs to attest from a cybersecurity. And it doesn't say management or exco, it says the board. So we're seeing a movement around the role of the board from a fiduciary perspective, around how do you think about technology? How do you think about security? How do you think about resilience? Because our role as board is to ensure our organizations are resilient. From an operations perspective, from a supplier perspective, from so many other things. But cyber has always been, you know, on the side. And that is really becoming very important for board members to really then understand, you know, when you talk about technology, when we're acquiring technologies, when you say we're going into different markets, when we're saying we are becoming a client-centric organization, when we say our strategy in 5 years is to grow to this, what technology do we then need to support that growth? And in that technology, what sort of threats are we introducing by bringing that technology?
Yeah.
So then you kind of need to have an understanding and appreciation of the technology landscape and an understanding and appreciation of security. What cybersecurity risks are we introducing when we have the strategy? So I think it's important for boards to really, and I often get this question, how do board members educate themselves?
Mm.
And there's this debate that's happening now globally around, do you bring a tech-specific director to sit on your board? Do you bring a cybersecurity-specific director to sit on your board? Or do you bring them in when these decisions are being made? So do you then have an external director that you opt in to the board when these decisions are being made? And how I answer that question, I says it depends.
Mm.
You know, it's important to understand. I often say it starts with your business strategy, then it goes to your technology strategy, then it actually needs to be supported by a cyber strategy. Because if you want to grow in 5 years into these markets, in acquisitions, what's the biggest thing that you need? Technology. Because we don't run around anymore now with bags. We actually need technology to support it. But then you need security. So I often say to organizations, it's important when you look at your strategy to say how much growth is in that strategy. How much of it would the core of it be dependent on technology? If the core is dependent on technology, then you actually need to start thinking, how do we educate our board members around technology? Or do we really need to get a technology specialist who sits on the board, who advises us as we make this decision, who's able to challenge the chief technology officer when they present something, who's able to say to the CISO when they present something that's very technical, can you just tone it down and tell us what the business risk is? When with this technology, can you just tell us what the business risk is? Because our role is to ensure that our business is resilient. So I often say it really depends on the size of the organization, the strategy of the organization. I mean, now you see most big banks have a subcommittee of the board, a technology subcommittee of the board, because they've realized the core business is technology. Because they're a technology platform. That's why you can go into your bank and do so many other things. That's why you can go into your app and buy app. I can buy airtime. I can play Lotto. I can. But it's because now they've created a platform. So they've now becoming a tech platform for all other third parties to come into. So it's important for organizations to think that. But then I say to the board members, I think it's important for us to also read up and understand and really appreciate where technology is going. And just have an understanding of what technology is, what technology means, and be able to ask those questions. By doing this, what business, what risk are we introducing, and how are we going to mitigate against that risk? And often ask questions. I mean, I am the simplest person, I think, even so in my teaching. I simplify things. I always say, just tell me what the business risk is. Just tell me how we're going to address that risk. So it's important for board members to really understand.
Yeah.
Have an appreciation and understanding. And if you don't, there's so many free courses. I say that to people. There's so many free courses. There's so many podcasts. There's so many that can just get you up to speed to really appreciate where we are.
Yeah, it's fascinating listening to you. And I'm, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about, you know how often with insurance, it's like a grudge purchase, right? You get insurance in the likelihood that you're going to have an accident, but you're not sure if you're going to have an accident. You pay the premium for 20 years, and then, you know, you've wasted all that money, and then you stop your insurance, and then you have an accident.
You have an accident,
Murphy's Law. But I, and, you know, The interesting thing from a marketing perspective that I've always noticed, with when you look across your buyer's journey in that regard, it's a fear-based transaction. Sometimes wonder if there's also that grudge purchase, like what's the ROI of this problem? Can we really prove that, all this money that we're spending, are we not just throwing it down the gutter? I mean, is this a crazy way to think like that?
It's you're spot on,
Oh,
Carmen.
okay.
The ROI question gets asked often, especially when you think when you talk about so when you talk about technology, we want to upgrade our front of house because it interacts directly with the customers. It's going to make Carmen's life a bit easy. That's an easy sell because I can see Carmen spend 20 minutes trying to do something in my environment, but because now we've upgraded with Carmen spends 5 minutes, so it means Carmen now has four purchases she can do over a period of time. So do you understand? So that one is easy because it's measurable. I have customer facing interfacing. It's often easier to get approval because the ROI can be calculated so quickly and can be measured so quickly. But when it comes to some of the technology from a cyber perspective, it's still a bit of a grudge purchase. And I think for me, there's two elements. The first element is that sometimes the CISO is not able to articulate what business risk they're solving for and how solving for that business risk is going to impact the bottom line. Because everything's about the bottom line. So it's CISOs not really being able to understand and link it to a business objective, to a business risk, and saying, this is where the risk is in a number of years, in 2 or 3 years' time, because that's technology takes a while to be embedded, to get the right people and the right processes. This is what the ROI is. So I think that's where some of the problem, and I think majority of it might come from that. The second part is that if an organization hasn't suffered a breach that they know of, remember we said that they are aware of, or that they know of, or that has cost them something, there's always this reluctance, like do I really have to have medical aid? I've never really been sick. I've been so healthy. A car insurance, do I really have to? So I think it's in both those ways. And I often say, to merge this, you actually need to get the CISO sitting in that room that I spoke about early. Sitting, when there's these boss barades, CISOs must be sitting there when there's conversations around where the organization is going, because then that will spark, because he's really hearing what's over and above what's written on the strategy. He's actually hearing the conversation that will make it to that 20-page strategy. And he can be able to articulate his strategy linked to not just that 20 piece, but to also the culture and the conversation that took place in there. The second part, until we have some sort of legislation that really enforces organizations to report a breach, whether it was an attempted breach or an actual breach, then you won't see the numbers. I mean, if you pick up any publication by most of the tech vendors, they'll often say a number of ransomware in South Africa was 60% of organizations suffered. And you're like, but living in this country, I don't hear it. I don't see it in the news. I don't see it because I follow quite a lot of regulators and some bodies. But it's because there isn't legislation to report. So I think as board members, then we actually need to start getting that data, subscribing to all these things. So you start understanding the landscape, not based on, that our organization, but really based on what is being reported, the research that's been done. That is not anywhere else because we have no legislation in
Yeah.
country.
Sure. It's a tough conundrum, hey?
It is very tough because you're constantly balancing.
Mm.
And if you think about the impact COVID had on businesses,
Sure,
they're
yeah.
still trying to pick up from some COVID still say when they report their results, pre-COVID, post-COVID, this is how we're looking like. But I think it's important to really try get that balance. But I often say it needs to start. Listen, if as a board member, what's important for us is whatever's being presented needs to be linked to our business strategy and objectives and show us how it's going to improve our bottom line.
Yeah.
So imagine you take that as a CISO, you start your story with that.
Yeah.
How do you think the conversations will change in the boardroom?
It's so fascinating. And, you know, one assumes like all the stakeholders are talking with one another. And then when you talk about these issues where the key stakeholders are perhaps not present, right? And when these strategies are put together, just shows the importance of stakeholder collaboration in order to, you know, mitigate some of these risks. And also to justify the budget allocation that goes towards some of these infrastructures, because, you know, it's the people that actually works on the ground with the technology. I mean, how many times do you look at change management or there's a new technology that's been adopted within the company and then nobody's using the technology, right? Because it's not doing the job properly. It's not really what we needed. It's like, it's so fascinating to me, and why communication is also so important. I think that that is to me ultimately the critical skill. And as you say, human shields, like,
Yeah,
you know.
it's taking people with you on the journey, and I mean, I've worked in organizations where they've invested so much in the technology because it's going to get people to be more efficient, but they still download and go work in Excel because they just said it's this technology is just so cumbersome. I don't really understand it. But imagine if you had taken, like you say, if you had taken the people with you on the journey from the beginning and asked them actually, what do you need? What is making your job hard? And then when you go purchase that technology, you're actually addressing, because 80% of the people will probably have the same pain point. So if you address that,
I mean, like we see this a lot also within customer experiences, like the tech stack integrations, right? Many times where technologies are purchased but that can't integrate properly into other systems. And, you know, once you realize that and you need to adapt and move into a new technology, you have to start all over again. It's such an expensive exercise.
And I guess that's why most boards would then, when it comes to technology spend, there's always that question about the ROI. It's because in my jobs, in our most of our jobs, we've experienced and we've seen it, and we're part of a tech that was bought with the latest whistles and bells, but actually nobody used it. And that's why linking it to the strategy.
That's it. That is the key. So bringing all of this together, going into the future and the trajectory that you are seeing within the threat landscape, and for companies to really get their armor together to be more cyber resilient, what would your parting thoughts be and advice of what they need in their toolbox?
So, you need quite a lot in your toolbox.
One, two, three, four.
And make sure it's still strong, hey, because sometimes you can't have that hammer that is so outdated and rusted. You just keep coming back to you. So I'd say you need to get your people's buy-in, and you need a culture that really understands and appreciate cybersecurity and cyber resilience. Actually, a culture that appreciates resilience and link resilience to their resilience, to what that means. So have people that want to be part of an organization that's solving for something bigger than them, and how that resilience impacts the spaces they operate in and the world they operate in, because people that are entering the workplace now are people that are more concerned about the bigger things. ESG impact they're going to have, the young people. And it's show them, use resilience, the topic of resilience, including cyber resilience, to show them what that would mean for them and for the world.
Yeah, I love that.
And secondly, you're not going to be able to protect everything. What are your crown jewels? What are
Oh, I
those
love that.
assets that you have now that you're going to integrate in the future, the technology stack that you're going to bring? What does it look like now? And how do you start making sure you're actually protecting that now? Thirdly, I've never met an organization that doesn't have third parties. everybody is working with somebody, whether it's somebody who comes to do your aircon, they have access to your network.
Yep.
Whether it's somebody who comes to clear your printer, they have access to your network.
Supply chain risks.
Supply chain risks, and yep. Not the immediate one. Those suppliers have another supplier. So now we're talking about second, third, fourth party suppliers. So have an appreciation and understanding of how that landscape looks like. And from a risk perspective, start looking after those.
Yeah.
There's a lot to do, but I think if you can start working on these three, and I mean, often linked to the business strategy, I think we can start seeing a little bit more resilience from a cyber perspective coming through. And remember what resilience means. Resilience means I have gone through a cyber attack, I've gone through a cyber incident, but how quickly do I recover? So it doesn't mean you are protecting yourself, you're never going to be hit. It means when I'm hit, when I'm vulnerabilities have been exploited, how quickly can these three help me get back to running my business?
I love that. And I think one of the things I also learned from you was the whole economic impact, how systems can be down for weeks. And what that economic impact can be. So resilience is so important in this landscape. Listen, I learned so much from you again, and thank you so much for being so open and sharing your wisdom with us for free.
Thank you. It has been absolutely awesome.
I really enjoyed that, and thank you so much. I must say, there's a part of technology that always switches me on. I find it so fascinating. I don't know why I like it so much. Maybe it's because I got six in my numbers. Six in my numbers is a technology number, numerology. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.